Well, what an honor to be here. What a group of women this is. Incredible long-term sobriety. You look beautiful. You look wonderful. This is really an honor to be asked to participate in the 40th convention of the International Women's Convention. When I was new, we heard about this little convention that was being held in Kansas City, and we weren't sure that it was quite right to have something that was just separate for women. And so it was viewed with suspicion, as all new things were. And in 1981, when it came to the West Coast, a bunch of us went down to investigate and found out what a wonderful group this is. And you can tell many of us are still coming back. So thank you for having us. And thank you for inviting me to be here. Buffalo throws a pretty good party, huh? Yeah. And we had some fantastic speakers so far. There was Mildred on Thursday night and Elliot last night. And about the fourth time that Elliot said, "You have an amazing speaker tomorrow night," a lady at the next table leaned over and said, "You better be good." So I'll try. No one has told me when I'm supposed to get off. And I have a watch, but I took my glasses off so I'd look cute, and I can't see it, so I'm here for the duration, and so are you. And I don't know why I'm here, why I have this honor. I never had intended to stay sober this long. I'd never intended to be this old, either. But one day at a time, I didn't drink, and I didn't die, and I got old. So here I am. I got to AA by accident. I wasn't looking for sobriety, and I wasn't looking for you. I was looking for a way to get back in the house. I woke up in a strange motel room. I was covered with blood. I didn't know if it was mine or someone else's, and I didn't stick around to find out. And I went home. I didn't know how long I'd been gone or where I'd been. And the door was locked. And the guy I was living with was on the other side of the door and said, "What are you doing here? You've been gone for 4 days. And I thought, well, this is useful information. I'll file this away. And I tried to plead my case. I don't know why I've been gone. I'll really be good. And I tried to get back. I just wanted to take a shower, that's all. And I said, and then the subject of my being gone drunk came up. And he said, "You got to do something about your drinking." And I said, "Well, I don't have a drinking problem. It's just that when I start, I can't stop." And finally, I said, I hit the magic words, and I said, "I promise I'll do something about my drinking." And he said, "Today." I said, "Yeah, okay, today." And I got back in the house. So I was in the shower thinking, well, what am I going to do now? I got back in the house, and this is all I wanted. But now I think I'm going to have to follow through. At least I have to prove my good intentions, and then I can forget about it, because I always do. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? So I thought about a group I'd heard of about 3 years before. There was a public service announcement in the TV station that I worked in. And it talked about Alcoholics Anonymous. This was in Tacoma, and it said they meet on Wednesday night at the library. And I thought about that. I read that announcement, and I thought about it, and I just happened to be down at the library one Wednesday night, and I thought, well, I'll just see what kind of people are here. Not one alcoholic came by. Nobody in a trench coat, nobody with a brown paper bag. All these people were going to the library, but they looked so nice. And so I thought, well, I don't know who they are, what they are, but they obviously aren't there, and I don't know how to find out about it. So that was the last I thought about it. And so this day, 3 years later, I remembered that, and I thought, well, I wonder if that group of people is in California. And so I looked up in the phone book, and there was a group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, well, that's amazing. They're everywhere now. And so I made a call, and this lady answered the phone. I said, hello, I'd like to make an appointment for next week for a friend. And she said, well, we're having a meeting right now, and you could come on down, and we'll talk about your friend later. So I waited a little while. I didn't really want to go down when they were having a meeting, so I rode my motorcycle over there in a little while and went into this club, and it was a ladies' meeting. It was just getting out. There were about 10 women in that town, sober at that time. And I met these women, and they were beautiful. They were elegant, they were sober, and they were very old. The first one that I talked to was the youngest of the whole group. She was 41. And there were people there in their 50s, 60s, 70s. And later when I went to a night meeting and met all the rest of the group, there were a lot of retired couples there. Many people in their 60s and 70s. And I said, I really don't belong here. I'm really too young to be an alcoholic. And most of them agreed with me. They'd never met anybody as young as I was trying to get sober and didn't really know what to do with me. But they said the only thing that they could do... Oh. Yeah. You always got to have a spare. Thank you. So I talked to these women, and they said the only thing that they knew to tell a newcomer, and that was, well, why don't you come back tomorrow night? It had been a long time since anybody asked me to come back anywhere. So I did. And I didn't know what they were. I went to a meeting, and then I went to another meeting, and I didn't know what this was all about. When do you talk about not drinking or drinking or how to drink? What is this thing? And I thought, well, maybe they'll talk about that tomorrow night. And so I went to another meeting. And so you kind of caught me. And I went to meetings for a while, but I concentrated on all the difficulties, all the differences, all the things that were hard. And I didn't want to take a look at any of the similarities and anything that made me like you, because I didn't want to be like you. And I didn't want to stay here. I got back in the house, and that's all I wanted. But I kind of got trapped into going to meetings, and so I did go, and I heard you talk about things, and I said, oh, those things haven't happened to me. I am so young. I am so innocent. I am so not like you. And so I went to less meetings, and then I went to even fewer meetings. And then pretty soon, I was just dropping in once in a while to see if anybody would talk to me, but I made sure they wouldn't. And I was nasty. I had a nasty, nasty temper, and I was not fun to be around. And I just dared you to say anything nice to me. So you didn't. And pretty soon, I got to thinking about how I really did want to drink. I really wanted to drink more than anything else. And one night, I was at a party with my boyfriend, and he said, well, wouldn't you really like to drink? Because it seemed he hadn't wanted me to get sober. He just wanted me to stop disappearing for days at a time. And so I took that drink. And in the 8 days that I drank, I found out that that AA can mess you up really bad. To start with, to get this drink, I drove across town to a liquor store, all 6 miles across town, and I thought, well, I don't have a phone. They told me to call somebody before I took a drink, but I don't have a phone, so I'll have to leave the house to call someone. And I got all the way across town, never passed the phone booth, and I said, well, I'll go ahead and buy this bottle, but then I'll call on the way home before I drink it. And, you know, I've been down that street since then, and there are whole bunches of phone booths, but there wasn't a one in sight that night. And so I went home and I said, well, I can't call now because I don't have a phone. So, but I'll only have one drink. So I uncorked this fifth. And I tipped it up. And the funniest thing happened, all these little tiny AA people started marching up to the side of the bottle and across the top. And they never left me alone. But in those 8 days that I drank, all the stuff that I said hadn't happened to me surfaced. I became all the things that they talked about in AA meetings came to the surface. I came out of a blackout knowing and agreeing with the fact that I was an alcoholic, that my life was over and that I had no place to go. I was a blackout drinker, and it had been very easy for me to say those things never happened to me because I wasn't there for most of it. Half the people in my life have shared what they know to be true about my drinking, and the other half have very thankfully kept quiet. But I came to some truth during that week. And I came out of this blackout, and I'd been gone for most of that week. I wasn't there. I don't know what happened. And coming out of this blackout, I didn't know yet that I'd been to the hospital. I didn't know that I had had alcoholic convulsions. I didn't know yet that I'd been suffering from DTs. I didn't know that I had smashed my leg. And while I didn't know this, I had taken off running because that's what I did. First would come the bottle, and then the shoes would go, and then the clothes would go, and then I'd go. And I could usually be seen running pell-mell down the street with someone trying to throw a blanket or a coat over me. And I had taken off running, not knowing that I couldn't walk. So I'd really messed up my leg, and I'd been to the hospital and back again, and the only thing that I knew when I surfaced out of this blackout was, I'm dead. I'm almost dead. And I didn't know why, and I didn't know all these things yet, but the thing that was there in my head was, they're right. I really am an alcoholic. I came face to face with that first step, all the powerlessness of alcoholism. It was all right there staring at me. And I looked across the room, and silhouetted against the window was this bottle of whiskey. And I thought, that's it. That's the thing that's got me to this place. And I thought it was all those people and all those things and all the stuff that I could blame on other people. And it wasn't. I knew it was the bottle of whiskey that was killing me. I knew and I accepted and I remembered that I'd started drinking when I was 12. I remembered that I was diagnosed with alcoholism when I was 15, and they gave me a pamphlet called 13 Steps to Alcoholism. And I've never seen that since, but I kept that for a long time. And when I crossed one, I'd check it off. And I was so glad to be an alcoholic then, because I thought, I can drink now, because I'm an alcoholic and I have to drink. And it was wonderful, just opened up the world to me then. And that's what I did. I was a daily drinker from the beginning. And the entire focus of my life was how to get that drink. And when you're a teenager, and the only thing that matters to you is how to get a drink, you get it however you can. When I was 16, I made a geographic cross country to get married. I looked up this guy. I hadn't seen him in a while. And I told him that we're going to get married, and he said, "I don't even like you." But that's what I wanted to do. So I finally wore him down, and we did get married. I was a virgin when I got married, except that I was 5 months pregnant. But I figured anything you did drunk didn't matter, didn't count. So it didn't count. And that was a very abusive situation. It was a really bad bad thing for me to be in. But the price that it was the price I paid to drink every day. Because he was an alcoholic. When I was 17, I was locked up in a mental institution. And they did let me out. By the time I went before the board, I was sober. And we can look pretty good when we get sober. And they said, the psychiatrist said, "You're saner than I am." And I thought, if you're going to let me out, that's probably true. I had a little baby, and I collected that kid, and I called up my parents, and I said, "I've just been in the hospital. I've been very ill, and I need to come home." And my dad, bless him, he only said, "Can you walk?" And he sent me a plane ticket. And they lived in by Tacoma, Washington, and they sent me a plane ticket home. And I went there, and I was going to start over. This was my chance to do it right and start over again. So I got home, got sober a little bit, and took off on another geographic. And this time I ended up in the hospital in the desert in Tucson. And I was hospitalized for acute alcoholism. And this time I called my parents, and I said, "I've had this terrible sunstroke, and I really have to be careful about going out in the sun, and I've been very ill, and I need to come home." And this time they sent me a bus ticket to San Francisco. Yeah, they still lived in Tacoma. So after a while, I made it back to where they lived again, and I started over one more time. And this time, I was started a career, and I went into radio and television. I worked at a TV station in Tacoma, and life was pretty good for a while. I was still. The focus of my life was how to get a drink, but I was ran with a crowd that made that possible for me. And then I went off to make my fortune. And I was hired as the first female disc jockey in the Central Coast of California. They spent a lot of money on me. They had a big promotion and a big fanfare, and they brought me down to California, and they said, "You know, this is a big thing here," because this was 1964, and there weren't very many females in a lot of the professional areas, and it was a big deal. And right away, I discovered two things about the radio business. One, being beautiful didn't matter in radio. And two, being drunk did. And it wasn't very long before they fired me. I thought it was really unfair. They fired me for coming to work. And I was a drunk, and I came to work, and they didn't like that. The thing that that followed was the loss of everything, because they had been paying for everything. They paid for my apartment, my food, everything. And then they pulled the rug out from under me and said, we can't support a drunk like you, and you have to go away. And all of a sudden I had no place to live, and no food and no job, and I was blacklisted in the industry. And I couldn't get a job. So I went to the streets. And I found it pretty easy there. There are very few rules on the street. You survive and you do what you do. And I found I was sleeping in a vacant lot one time, and there's this little church mobile, I call it, that came around and would scoop up people and help them. And they came around, they scooped me up and they took me over to this church lady's place. And she said, we will help you. We will take care of you. And I said, oh, this is great. And I had my son with me. And I thought, oh, this is really good because they can take care of him and I don't have to. And I really tried. I gave it a try to stay there, but they had so many rules. You couldn't drink. You had to take showers. You had to eat food, and on, just all these rules. So I'd leave, and I'd leave him there because they would take care of him. And I'd show up every now and then. I'd be sick, and they'd take me in, and they'd nurse me back to health. And one time I came in, and I'd been sliced up with a razor blade, and I had blood poisoning. And the lady sat up with me for 4 days. And she nursed me, and I wouldn't let her call the police or the hospital or anything. And if I died, it was all right with me. I never had a problem with that from the beginning, and I never expected to live very long, so that was okay. But she nursed me back to health, and as soon as I was well, I left again. And when I showed up the next time, she said, I can't let you do this to me anymore. I love you. And I love your boy, but I can't keep him for you anymore, and I can't keep taking care of you. You have to leave. And it broke her heart. It was the hardest thing I think she ever had to do, because it was her nature to open her heart. But I broke it one too many times. So I went back to the street, and that's every now and then somebody picked me up and take me home. That's the nature of it. And that's where I was when I found myself wanting to get back in the house. I was living with somebody for a little while, and it was really important that I find a way back in, and then I protect that home for a while. I didn't want to go back on the street right then, and I was willing to do what I could do to keep that place to live. And I knew all these things when I came out of that blackout, and I knew the sense of what they spoke about when they talked about the first step and the powerlessness of alcohol and that my life was unmanageable, and I knew all of this. And I knew too that I could not live, I would not live if I didn't take a drink that night. And I knew I would not live if I did take one. And I sent somebody out to call AA, because it was very important that I knew that I could come back to AA. I knew that I would not be able to take a drink by myself. I couldn't do it. I could not live the rest of the night without drinking, without taking a drink. And I had to find out if I could come back. Well, they called the women in AA, all 10 of them. And one by one they said, I am not getting out of bed and go talk to her. She's not going to make it. But one lady, she's a little crazy. People didn't have too much to do with her. But she got out of bed. And she couldn't find any other woman to go with her, so she brought a man, and they came to my house at 1 o'clock in the morning. And I have no idea what they talked about, because that wasn't the point. They showed up. They were there, and they told me I could come back and it was okay. And I knew that I could stay the rest of the night without taking a drink, because I believed them. And I knew I was going to go back to AA the next day. I didn't welcome this with open arms and a warm, fuzzy heart, but I didn't want to die right then. I did figure that I'd go back to AA and I'd get sober maybe a couple of weeks or so, and then I'd kill myself. But I just didn't want to die drunk, knowing that bottle of whiskey was what got me there. What ego I had said, you don't want to go out as a drunk. Kill yourself when you're sober, and that's okay. I don't care what gets you to AA. As long as you get back, it's all okay. And the next morning, I went back to the doctor to get my leg checked and see how I was. And he didn't think that I'd be able to go the rest of the day without a drink. He said, you know, the next drink you pick up, you'll be dead inside of 3 days. And I thought, well, I wish I'd known I had 2 more days to drink. So they took me to my first meeting, coming back. I couldn't walk. I couldn't walk for 2 months. They stuck me in a chair, and they put my crutches someplace else. And I couldn't walk out of the meeting. I've been doing that for a while. And I couldn't do that anymore. I had to sit through the whole thing. Because you see, you talked about God in meetings. I couldn't stand that. So I was used to walking out when that started. And I had to sit there and I had to listen to you talk about all these things that I hated. I was not a friendly person. I didn't know how to relate to you, and I didn't really try. And the women, bless their hearts, who were there did not know how to relate to me either. They tried. But here's how my relationships were. One lady said, I will help you do anything to keep from taking a drink, but don't talk to me about your personal life. She said, I got a daughter your age, and I can't talk to her, and I won't talk to you. And I said, well, I got a mother your age, and I wouldn't talk to her either. So, and so we had this truce. I'd go to meetings, and I wouldn't talk, and I wouldn't talk after the meetings, and you'd give me things to do to keep from taking a drink. And that's the way we lived. So for about a year and a half, this is what I did. You told me to do things. I would call somebody and say, how do I get through the next 10 minutes? And you tell me. You give me something to do, something to read, something to scrub. I scrubbed more stuff. I scrubbed things with a toothbrush. I scrubbed walls. I scrubbed everything when you told me to, which was whenever I called you. Before I could walk, and I was still on my crutches, and I knew that I could get to a drink. I wasn't confined. I could get to meetings, and I still needed to know how to keep from drinking. It was an agonizing ache inside me. I wanted to drink so bad every single minute. And one of the women said, well, you could sew. I said, I ride motorcycles. I don't sew. And she said, well, fine, you can drink then. I have this quilt. It took me 5 years to make this quilt. I did every blessed thing those women told me to do. The first year that I started on this quilt, within the first couple of months of sobriety, I only put black pieces in it. And then I added some brown. Few pieces of gray, and the second year I put in some dark blue. In the fifth year that I put that thing together, I added some red and some yellow, and they just all cheered. So I followed the directions of all the women who reached out to me. And I was lonely, and I knew I was different, and I knew that I didn't know what was in store for me. All I could do for that long period of time was just stay sober, just a few minutes at a time, an hour at a time. Sometimes I could even get up to a day. But I always, always wanted to drink. They told me things like, if you stick around and you learn to talk about God and you learn to do the things we do, you'll become just like us. And I thought, oh, that's real motivation. Hang out for the rest of my life in this retirement community. I can hardly wait. There was no one there who could do anything for me other than just keep reaching out their hand and keep telling me how to not take that drink. After about a year, I found my way to a convention, and I found people in that convention who were under 40, and it was the first time I'd ever met anybody sober under 40. It was a new world. There were young people's meetings there was one in San Diego. There was one in Laguna Beach, which was the center of the universe right then. And there was one in Hollywood. And I started driving down to Hollywood on a Friday night, 200 miles, to spend the weekend with other people. There were people in their 30s. There were three people younger than I was. And this was just incredible. So I found some people to be with and to learn from. And it wasn't so lonely anymore. We started a young people's, Southern California Young People's Intergroup. And we traveled around starting young people's groups. And from those three groups in Southern California, we started the other young people's groups all over California. And it was incredible. It was a fellowship. It was a journey together. And it gave me something that I could do. One of the things that I did not learn to do for a couple of years was work the program. That never really occurred to me. I was so busy trying to not drink and calling people saying, what do I do for 10 minutes, that I never really got beyond that. And one day, I was sober a year and a half, I went to this ladies' meeting. I had made this commitment. I will go to this women's meeting every day, every week, every Tuesday. I will sit there and hate them, but I will go. And I did this. I went to this meeting one Tuesday. And the world had folded in around me so much, I couldn't bear it anymore. And I said, in that meeting, I said, please tell me that there's more. Please tell me that I can do something else besides scrub something or read something or sew something. And they went around the room, those 10, 12 women by now, and said, first things first, easy does it. All the slogans, they pulled them all out, and they really tried to help me. And when I left that meeting, I said, you know what? AA doesn't work for people like me. I can't stay sober. So I headed for a liquor store. There was one woman who hadn't been at that meeting, though. She was pretty new to town, and she hadn't been there. And I thought, well, I'm going to give her a chance. See if maybe she's got something that they didn't have to give me. And I went to her house, showed up on her doorstep, And I said, I'm going to drink. And she said, well, you can if you want to. And I thought, oh, no, no, you're not supposed to say that. You're supposed to say, oh, what can I do to get you through this? And that's what I was used to. And she didn't do that. She said, you can if you want to, but you don't have to. She said, there's a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and this program has 12 steps, and you could work some of them. And she said, oh, no, no, not that. But we talked for a while, and I said, well, the truth is, I know that I came face to face with my powerlessness. There is no question that I've taken that step. There is no question that the ability to recognize that there is a power greater than myself, and that's the group. I know that I can be restored to whatever sanity there is. I believe in that, but I can't take the fourth step that you're talking about because I can't take the third step. There is no God. I have none. I don't believe, and I can't go any farther than this. AA does not work for people like me. She said, well, that's okay. You can borrow mine. And if you don't have anything to turn your life over to for a couple of days, you can turn it over to me. And I'll be there with you every minute. She was my lifeline. And I wrote for several days. I did the fourth step exactly. Well, I took the third step that day with her. I took my form of it. And I said to my borrowed person here, my borrowed thing here, I will work the steps as it's outlined in the book. And when it doesn't work, I'm going to get drunk, okay? And that was fine. And that was what I turned myself over to. And I followed the directions. And I talked with her. I read my inventory to her, and with experienced the humility and everything that comes from the sixth and seventh steps, and the willingness to let these things go. When I left her house, I had a list of people I knew that I had to make amends to, and instructions from her on how to start that. A couple of weeks later, I realized I hadn't wanted to drink. And it was the first time since I was 12 years old. I couldn't believe it. And I thought, maybe this thing works. Maybe I'm not going to have to kill myself. Maybe I can stay here. Maybe it's going to work. And I slowly began to become a part of the group and a part of AA. I was real comfortable. I was okay with myself. I was okay with my life. Things were good. After I'd been sober about 5 years, I thought, okay, now there's another layer that has to come off here, because I have been the person that they wanted me to be for 5 years. I've talked about their God. I have talked about their life. I have said that I want all the things that they have in their life. But I'm comfortable now, and I think it's time to be honest. And I'd known I was a lesbian since I was 12, coincidentally, about the time I started drinking. And I decided that, and I'd been waiting to meet other people like me. And this was in the late 60s. There was nobody talking. And I would go to meetings where somebody was sighted, heard there was a lesbian and fight. So I went to a meeting there. But I didn't hear anybody talking. And so finally I said, okay, I'm gonna have to just be honest, and if I'm open, and if I'm myself, and I'm all okay, then they'll find me. And this was exciting. So I stood up in a meeting one time, and I said, I've been living a lie, and I'm gonna start talking about it. So somebody said, well, I'll give a talk at the Alana Club next Sunday. And you can tell us about it. And I said, oh, that's great. So I'm all excited. I'm gonna tell everybody all my secrets. I'm gonna be okay. And on Saturday, I went to I had a motorcycle riding buddy, and we went on a 200 mile run. And all the time, I'm thinking, oh, I am so happy. I am being me. I am so free. We got back to his place, and after the run, and first time he'd done this, he said, hey, let's go to bed. And I said, oh man, this is my chance. This is my best friend. This is my chance to be free. And so I said, no, I don't want to do that. I like women. It was the first time I'd ever said that to anybody in my life. And he hit me. The next several hours, I had not experienced that kind of shame and degradation in all the 5 years that I'd been sober. I went back to my apartment in the morning, looked at myself in the mirror, my face was pretty messed up, and I looked into my own eyes, and I said, well, I haven't been a lesbian very long, but it's not nearly as much fun as I thought it was going to be. And I gave this talk about, you just put the plug in the jug and everything is just fine. And people said, what is this big thing we're going to tell us about? And I said, oh, nothing. I'm just fine. And I decided that I had made myself vulnerable, and I would never, ever do that again. Not ever. I packed that all up. I put it on the shelf. You told me. Put it on the shelf if you don't like it. And I put it there, and it stayed there. And I said, okay, what I need is a husband and a family to be normal. And I found this very wonderful man. I married him. He had 3 kids. We had 2 more. I got mine back. And we have this perfect family. And we lived that way for 10, 11 years. It was perfect. We were the AA couple. In that little town, we were the epitome of what you can be when you stay sober. Mr. and Mrs. A. It was wonderful. He was a wonderful man. Just wonderful. And I was satisfied with my life. I thought, okay, this is the way it's going to be. And it was, until this cute little gym teacher walked in and said, would you be my sponsor? And I wasn't alone anymore. Well, this was the early 80s. There were gay meetings listed, and I did find one 60 miles away, and I said, okay, this has been my choice, but I can't let her die because of my fear. And so I packed her up, and I took her to a meeting every week. I went with her. That was big of me. And introduced her to her people. And in doing so, I found people that were just like me. And it stayed like this for a few years. And then finally, I knew that I had to work this program in all of its entirety with all the honesty that I could. And so with the rigorous honesty that comes of being 17 years sober, I went to my husband and said, I'm leaving and it's all your fault. Well, he wasn't going for that because things had been too good for so long. So he found out and he tried to get me to stay by saying, if you leave, you'll never see your children again. And I knew that I would die because I wanted to drink off of this. I drove out of my yard and left the children waving goodbye. And I left. And what I found for the next several years was that I had to live the way you had. I had packed up all those feelings to put them away. And it was easy for me to sponsor people because I could say, what is the problem? Just do it. So leave him. So kill him. So do something. Because I never had to be emotionally involved. And all of a sudden, I was living like you had been living, all of your sobriety, and it wasn't much fun. Well, I went to the International Women's Conference in Phoenix, met a woman and moved in with her. I love these conferences. Each one has been momentous in its own way. And that relationship broke up after a few years, and I found myself in meetings crying. In one meeting, I said, I don't understand. My relationship broke up 5 days ago, and I still hurt. I don't get it. And it was just so foreign for me to feel everything, but you see, I was me for the very first time in my life. I wasn't hiding anything. I was living like a sober person. And those things hurt. It hurts to stay sober sometimes when there's so much pain. Sometimes it hurts when there's so much joy, just because you feel it all. But I sat there and I hurt. And this man said to me, look, you've been sober 20 years. The girl over there had been sober about 20 minutes. Why don't you tell her how you're not going to drink today? And I did that. And I worked with some women, and I spent some time talking to women and saying, look, I know what you're going through, and I really do. And you don't have to drink. And here's what you can do instead. And this is what I'm going to do today, and I'm not going to drink. And how about you? Oh, it's so incredible. One of those women I met in the hallway last night, and we remembered each other from those days. And she's sober and here tonight, I think. And this wonderful, wonderful program teaches us to pass this stuff on. This is a program of living without drinking. And in order to do that, we have to experience all of life, whether we want to or not, and then not pick up a drink when we feel it all. Well, I didn't know that. It was all new to me, too. But the thing that held me together, I found out, was the anger that I felt. I had always been full of anger, and now I had the freedom. But I still had the anger. It was all wrapped around everything. I was so angry at losing things, at being forced to feel everything. And it was just there. It was in everything that I did, everything that I said. It was all this anger. And the night before my 22nd birthday, I was really striving to get some help. I went to this class on anger management, and I left there so angry. One of the women there said, when I'm washing dishes and he comes up and puts his hands around me from behind, I just get so angry. And I thought, I got him. I don't relate here. I mean, I have some real anger, and I came face to face with my program again. The 11th step was mocking me. I had nothing. I had borrowed this higher power 20 years before, and it was time to do something different. I was headed home on the freeway, and I thought, I can't do this. I can't bear it. People like me can't stay sober. One more time. So my answer was to kick the car up to 75, take my hands off the steering wheel, and close my eyes. And I said to whoever, whatever, do with me what you will. And I waited to die. And after a little while, there was no crash, nothing saw from my eyes. This is the Los Angeles freeway at 6 p.m. There were no cars in any of the lanes around me. So I thought, okay, I'm not supposed to die. I'm supposed to do something else. And I went on home. It was time for me to peel back one more layer. I took another inventory. I wrote about all this anger. And I found I had taken inventories all along, and everyone that I took peeled back a little bit more. And this one reached underneath, and it hit the core of what I believed in, which was nothing. I had to hold on to all of this anger because it was the cement that glued me together. Because if I wasn't angry, I didn't exist. I found that I believed in absolutely nothing. And I wanted to change, and I wanted to live. I found a woman, had a friend, was not an AA, but she had a spiritual being that I admired and respected. And I went to her and I asked her if she would teach me how to pray. We went out to this place on my property, on my ranch. This is an old Native American campground. And 400 years ago, there was a healing lodge in this little grove. We went into this grove and we connected to the energy that we felt there. And she taught me how to pray. And I began to do that. And I began to replace some of the emptiness. I had this hole inside me, and that's what had terrified me for so many years. And I had to cover it all up and wrap it all around with anger so that I wouldn't find out that there was nothing inside. I began to reach out. I began to fill this hole. And I lived. And I experienced. And I believed. Well, this isn't an 11-step program. I have to take the spirit. I have to let it change me. And then I have to pass it on. I have to keep giving this message to anyone I can, when I'm asked, where I'm asked. And maybe it doesn't mean anything to you, but it does to me. The message that that Bill passed on to Dr. Bob in 1935 was that he reached out his hand and he said, there is hope and there is life. And you can have it if you want, and you don't have to drink again. And they turned to someone else, and they reached out their hand, and they offered the same thing to someone else. And through the years, those hands have been reaching out, and others have been taking them. For 40 years, this convention and these women, and you wonderful, remarkable women, have reached out your hands. And you've been there when other people came along. I need to reach out. I need to hold the hand of somebody who's been there. I'm gonna let them pull me along for a little while. Let them hold me up for a little while. Tug me along, maybe. You women did this for me for 37 years now. But I can't let it stop there. I have to turn around and give this to somebody else, reach out my hand and let them grab it. Tug them along a little bit, pull them along, let them rest a little while. And then they get to do that for somebody else. This convention has been doing that for each other, for all of us, for 40 years. Witness the incredible amount of long-term sobriety here. We've been doing this a long time. I only have the message of sobriety, that you can stay sober no matter what. It's a message of one day at a time. It's a message that even when you can't do it anymore, even when it's totally unbearable, when you just can't go one more step, you still don't have to drink. When that happens, you reach out and you grab onto somebody who's walked that path before and you hold on. And then you grab somebody up behind you and you let them follow you on for a little while. This chain of sobriety has been unbroken since 1935. As long as we keep reaching out to each other and holding on to each other. We can't do this alone. We need each other. And if we hold on to each other real tight and we don't let go, we don't ever have to walk alone again. Thank you for my life.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com. Thank you.